Audience in the country, this is Jason Troyer, filling in for Bob Benyard, America's most popular, self-proclaimed right-wing religious fanatic, homophobic, anti-choice talk show host. Well, how was your Easter Sunday? I, personally, had a great time. Well, first we started off with the way we should start off every Easter Sunday, going to church and worshiping God, and remembering why we're actually there on Sunday. We had a packed house at the church, as you would expect, on Easter. We had about 80 people there, all pretty much regulars. It just kind of depends on, the parents who have hockey games on certain weekends and certain things going on. And so we generally average about 50, but we peaked at around 80, but all familiar faces. And we had some very exciting news. We had an announcement on Sunday that yet another one of our members is going to give birth. So that raises the total to 6 members of the church that are pregnant right now. Now Cheryl, she's about to bust. She's about to go at any time. So maybe even by next Sunday we'll only have 5. But anyway, we're glad that we are procreating. Where our goal is to have at least one member of the church pregnant at all times. That's a good goal, isn't it, Carl? I think so. That's a good goal. Now, Bob said we should try to have one member of the church pregnant in each row every Sunday. But I thought that was going a little overboard. So I think one member of the church pregnant at all times. I mean, because, gestation's 9 months. So, I mean, that's a good span. We only need one every 9 months. So anyway, the nursery is full to overflowing, but we'll manage somehow. And then after church, we of course did the holiday abortionist home visit. Now, I unfortunately was not allowed in the neighborhood due to, 3 restraining orders that keep me out of the neighborhood. They just don't like me, folks. I don't get it. But so I went to the usual rendezvous just outside the neighborhood at a major thoroughfare. And I did my protesting up there, even chatted with a cop, and so we did that. And then, of course, we can't protest all day long, so we had a family from the church invite us over for Sunday dinner, and we had a wonderful, delicious, speaking as a bachelor, of course, a wonderful Sunday dinner. Carl, it was delicious, wasn't it? Absolutely. Carl is shaking his head. He had a great time. We played some games, did some things, fellowshipped. And we didn't leave until like 8 o'clock at night, which meant I had to go right into work, so I got no sleep. But it was worth it, because that's what life is all about. It's about relationships, and it's about building relationships with people, having a good time, fellowshipping, and not being ashamed of what you did the day after. Not wondering what you did, and not being ashamed of what you did the day after. And you can only do that as a Christian. Have a good time, and be proud of the good time that you had, and not have any regrets about it. So anyway, let's get back to the first part of the day, and that is the Sunday sermon, of course. And being Easter, we talked about, the Easter Bunny and, not the whole sermon. Well, we did talk about the Easter Bunny. And so this is a sermon entitled, Where Did Easter Come From?
Yesterday, a worker at Home Depot said to our 3-year-old son, Zachary, "Are you excited about the Easter Bunny coming?" And if ever a 3-year-old gave a look that suggested the adult might be off his medications, it was that. The Easter Bunny is coming, and he's bringing colored Easter eggs and chocolate ones. But bunnies don't lay eggs, especially not chocolate ones. No, Cheryl and I, we're not spoil sports. We don't tell our kids there's no Easter bunny. It just never came up. But we would tell them that no one believes in the Easter bunny. No adults. Have you ever met an adult that believes? I haven't. That's just a myth designed to take our collective minds off of Jesus Christ, who rose from the dead 2,000 years ago on a Sunday to bring us new life. The world constantly throws distractions in the way of believing in Jesus. Jesus rose to bring new life, eternal life, to those of us who humble ourselves and who, when our sins are forgiven by God, by us putting our faith in Jesus Christ, that's why he came, died, and rose from the dead. But rather than remembering his resurrection day, the world distracts itself with a closely related topic of new life. And they focus on that. Not that Jesus died and rose, but just new life for Easter, spring. It's time for a fertility festival, as most of the pagan world celebrate it for millennia. Because a half-truth deceives better than an outright complete lie. And so the world celebrates something called Easter. Now, I don't make a rule that says you can't say Easter. We use the term Easter, but we also frequently speak of Resurrection Sunday. Because the term Easter is not found in the Bible. You can't look it up and find a verse that says, and it was Easter. No, it doesn't say that. And using symbols also not found in the Bible, we celebrate Easter as a culture as a feast of fertility and reproduction. So we don't use the birds and the bees for Easter, but we use rabbits and eggs, both symbols of breeding. So if this day is the celebration of Christ's resurrection, why do we call it Easter? Where do we get that from? Well, in the world's concerted effort to detract from Jesus Christ, it's taken the resurrection theme of new life, and it used that to recall an ancient practice of worship to a pagan goddess, the fertility goddess Ishtar. Ishtar, that's where we get Easter from. Now, some have argued historically the early Christians were persecuted, and so to avoid being thrown in prison or tortured or martyred, they would change some of their customs to pick up the names of pagan practices. So while the government officials are worshiping Ishtar, they're worshiping Easter, and they hope to blend in. That could be. But we should not allow ourselves to let the world succeed in their efforts to detract from Christ. The pagan goddess of fertility, Ishtar, was also called Asherah by the Canaanites. We've heard of the Ashtaroths in the Bible and the Baals in Asherah. That's Ishtar. The Greeks and Romans had the same goddess that they worshipped, but they called her Aphrodite. And in fact, when I was in Israel, a number of us here were in Israel just a few weeks ago, every time I go, I try to bring back learning tools, perfumes in the Bible, maps, books, atlases. And this time, a friend of mine, Mike Tiemann from Las Vegas, he was there with us at the Dead Sea Scroll Museum in Jerusalem, the Shrine of the Book. He got this, an ancient sculpture of Aphrodite, an ancient Greek sculpture. Now, the Canaanites, when they made an idol to a pagan god, they made some weird-looking form, and they worshipped it as their god Ishtar, Easter. And the Greeks and the Romans, a little bit more civilized, they cultured it a bit, made her look better, so they had a more respectable pagan worship. So that's why this day is called Easter. It's a throwback to ancient paganism, the fertility goddess and all, the rabbits, eggs, The myth of the Easter Bunny is just a diversionary attempt so that we would forget about the symbol that we have on the wall in front of our church. Now, one of the men in our church, Brian Rohrbaugh, made this. In fact, it reminds me of another cross that he destroyed, that we're very thankful that he did. And then he made this, and we've hung it here, and there's no one on the cross. Some Christians have a cross with a dead body on it, symbolizing Christ, and yes, he was crucified. And that's acceptable to remember that Christ died on the cross. But on this day, of all days, we remember that he's not on the cross, he's not in the tomb, because God raised him from the dead. This is Resurrection Sunday. As a teenager in New Jersey, I remember a mainline church, and their bulletin during the Christmas season had a drawing on a back page of a man saying, "Come unto me, all ye children." And it was a drawing of Santa Claus usurping the role of Jesus Christ. Hollywood's movie, Miracle on 34th Street, notwithstanding, I've never met an adult who believes in Santa Claus. Not one. But I have met many rational adults who believe that 2,000 years ago, a man in Israel named Jesus Christ was crucified, buried, and 3 days later rose from the dead to die no more. Now, not everyone believes that. On KOA Radio a few years back, I had just gotten back from my period of time commuting to Indiana and back. That was a tough time for Cheryl and I. And I finally came back. I didn't have to go every week fly to Indiana anymore. And I remember my first full day back, I turn on KOA Radio, and they're debating whether or not Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And the caller said to the host, who I didn't recognize, even though he's on our number one radio station, he was a new guy. The caller said, "Well, in what way is the evidence insufficient for you to believe that Christ rose from the dead? To me, when I've looked at the evidence, it's overwhelming that he did. So how is it insufficient? Where do you find it weak?" And how do you think the talk show host responded? You think, let's go to a commercial break. You think he outlined where the evidence for Christ's resurrection is weak? Last year, on Resurrection Sunday, I spent time giving evidence for the resurrection, as we've done in so many sermons and so many Bible studies. So I'm not going to do that today. If anybody wants evidence, we might have a video right here. I don't know. Do we have a Mount Moriah video? Somewhere over there. We'll get you one if you'd like one. We have a tremendous amount of evidence that Christ rose from the dead. But this talk show host, he didn't point out, "Well, I don't believe because of this." He just screamed a vulgar curse against Jesus Christ. Just startling. And I thought, I go away for 3 years, I come back, and Denver's become this? This filthy? And I'm thankful of the events that transpired next. I called in. I had Art Risley's cell phone in my car. That was my first cell phone. Art lent it to me for a while. And I called up KOA and said, "Hey, I'm a producer of a national TV talk show, and I'd like to get a tape of this program to use on the show." And the talk show host, so conceited, even though he had just done a vulgar and filthy thing, he said, "All right, come on in, we'll give it to you." I went right in and got the tape. And I played a segment of the tape for KOA's largest advertiser, Stevenson, what is it? Chevrolet. And for the general manager, Bill Larson. And I won't even intimate what was said. It was so filthy and vile. And Mr. Stevenson, his name Bill Stevenson, Ken Stevenson, he said, are you showing this to all the advertisers to try to get them to stop advertising? I said, "No, just you. You're the only one." because I had heard that, I don't know his spiritual background, but I had heard he's sensitive to Christianity. And the general manager of KOA, in fact, all the Clear Channel stations in town. And they yanked that show that week. That was the last time that guy ever appeared on KOA. And I was really thankful that we could do that. Because even in this age when our culture does everything it can to distract from Jesus Christ, we can stand up for him. And we could honor him with our words and our lives, our actions. So I've met a lot of people who believe, they've looked at the evidence, and they believe that Jesus Christ rose from the dead. Even some of the greatest minds in history, like Isaac Newton and Galileo, from this very pulpit, we've read their quotes, where they have considered the evidence, and they believe that Jesus Christ died and rose from the dead. But the world distracts us from that truth. NPR, National Public Radio, this morning, it's Easter. We're driving into church, and I asked Nathaniel, do you think I should talk about this NPR? Because they're Easter stories. They reported four stories for Easter. You think they really cover it from every angle. But somehow they forgot to mention that it was about Jesus and that he rose from the dead on this day. Or even that that was claimed. In all four stories, I didn't hear the name Jesus or the resurrection. Not even that it was true or false. It just wasn't in the story. The first story was the Pope did a mass in Rome and called for peace and a cessation of violence in the Middle East. Okay, that's a good story. Second story was in England, there was going to be a music celebration for Easter, and it was canceled for hoof and mouth disease. Okay. The third story was on organ players and how it's a dying art, church organs. And they ended with a quote from the organist at a United Methodist Church in Indianapolis, not Neil Copley. He's resigned from the Indianapolis. It might be the same church now. But a quote from him saying, organ music is the best way to worship God. Huh? How so? NPR didn't care how so. The more stupid it sounds, the better, as far as they're concerned. And the fourth Easter story they did was about hats that women wear to church. And the most memorable part of that segment was the three sizes of the hats that black women wear to church on Easter. They're big, bigger, and why'd you sit in front of me? That was NPR's Easter programming. Now, the Gospel of Matthew says that after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week began to dawn, and Jesus Christ rose from the dead. And that's when Christ arose, after the Sabbath. What day of the week is the Sabbath? Anybody recall? Saturday. And the first day of the week dawned and Christ rose. Now the Sabbath, that's the seventh day. God created in 6 days and rested on the seventh. And hence, the Sabbath is the end of the week. And the first day of the week is Sunday. And just as Resurrection Day has been co-opted to remember Ishtar and fertility, so the names of the days of the week have pagan origins also. Sunday and Monday, what do you think those names refer to? Sun and the moon. And the pagans would worship the sun and the moon. And so we have Sunday and Monday. The Bible says, don't worship the sun or the moon or the stars, only worship the Creator. Only worship God. Not dirt. Don't worship dirt. Don't worship rocks. Don't worship fire. Worship the Creator. Even the old Sabbath day was named for the worship of Saturn, the sixth planet in our solar system, as Saturday. That's what my car is named after. Thousands of years ago, the outer planets, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, They were unknown to the Babylonian astronomers and pagans. They didn't know about those planets, so they only knew, other than the Earth, they only knew five. And what they did was they named the 7 days of the week for those five planets plus the sun and the moon. And that's where we get the names of our days, except it filtered through the Roman Empire, and the Romans had their names, their Latin names for the Babylonian names of those planets, and that's where we get the days of our week. Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday are for the five planets other than the Earth, the last being Saturn's day. And this pattern follows in other languages. For example, in Spanish, we have lunes. Right? What's lunes for? Lunar. And I don't even know all the days of the week in Spanish, but we have martes. What planet do you think that is? Mars. And miércoles. Mercury. And let's see, I know we have a viernes in there somewhere. That's Venus. So, a few weeks ago, I debated the existence of God with a scientist. We recorded it, and he writes occasionally for Scientific American. His name is Michael Shermer. And I mentioned to him, I try to find some common ground. Where he's an atheist, he believes in evolution. I believe in God, Jesus Christ, and that the Lord created us, and that we've not evolved from slime. I don't believe in goo through the zoo to you. I don't believe in that. I believe we're made in the image of God. So I want to find some common ground at least. Because if you have a debate, find out where you agree, and then go from there. Find out where the disagreement really begins. So in searching for common ground, I thought of this one little piece of the Bible teaching that perhaps he could publicly say, well, that's true. At least a little piece. So I reminded him of the ancient world when much of it was worshiping the sun and the moon and the stars. And he recalled that. I said, isn't it at least one little mark in the Bible's favor that the Bible said, don't worship the sun, the moon, and the stars. They're lights. They're not gods. They're lights. Don't worship them. I said, isn't at least that much accurate? He said, no. I said, what do you mean, no? How could you disagree with that, even that little bit? And so he said, where does the Bible say? Oh, and by the way, he's done a series on atheism at, I think it was Berkeley, a major lecture series. He's the founder of the Skeptic Society and the publisher of Skeptics Magazine. He writes for Scientific American. And he says to me, in his purpose in life, other than being a scientist, is to refute Christianity and the Bible. So he says to me, where does the Bible say the sun and the moon and the stars are for lights? Where does it say that? I said, well, somewhere in Genesis chapter 1. You don't have to go too far to find it. So he's like, oh, where? So I had to look it up and read it to him. And so then he resorted to this. He said, I said, well, so can't you at least agree the Bible was at least right when it said the sun is a light? He said, no, that's not true. I said, that's not true? The sun is not a light? No, it's not a light. The sun? I'm just beside myself, incredulous. Here's a scientist who should be able to take me apart in a debate because I'm an ignorant internet talk show host, right-wing religious fanatic. So I'm incredulous. The sun is not a light. It doesn't light our world. It's not the light of the solar system. It's not. And I kept pressing him on it. And did he budge at all? Doug, do you remember? Jason, maybe? Hardly. Carl, do you remember? Did he finally say, okay, it is a light? Hardly. He maybe moved a little tiny bit. Why would he argue that the sun is not a light? Why would he argue that? It's what we've been saying for years. It doesn't matter if we talk to a student in a general science class or the teacher or a college science professor or a nationally known scientist. When science upholds the Bible in any way whatsoever, they reject science out of hand in order to defend their hatred of the Bible. That's what we find over and over and over. Because the people I know in my life, 42 years, I've known a lot of people in all the jobs, industries I've had, family members, neighbors, friends, enemies. And I've found everywhere in the country I've gone, through every stage of my life, the people with a passion for science that goes through all the age levels, and a very high percentage of the people I meet are the conservative right-wing Christians. Because they love science, because it helps illuminate the Bible and the Creator, and it affirms our worldview. We love science. And if there's some find in science that threatens our view, we say, well, we want to know more about it. We want to know more. We want to get the research papers. We want to see. But he was afraid even to affirm one of the most basic findings of modern science, that the sun is a light. It's not a god. You don't worship it. You don't pray to it. It's burning. It's on fire. It's like a torch. You light your house with a little chemical reaction. He could not give credit to even the small piece of scientific evidence in favor of the Bible, because it threatens his eternal soul. Because if the Bible is right, he's in big trouble. Because the world is filled with hurt and pain and hatred of men toward one another. This Tuesday night, 60 Minutes, CBS will air, and as many as 20 million people will watch a program on Columbine. Our church has family members who've lost a son, a grandson, at Columbine. And here you got two young kids murdering their classmates, shooting at teachers. And it turns out it's epidemic in America. It's happening on a regular basis. That's a new twist to the old plot, the old theme of the story, that men hate one another and they hurt one another. And they typically hurt those who are closest to them the most. So God has a choice. He either lets us hurt one another forever without intervening, or he says, I will only be patient for so long. And at that time, when I bring about my judgment, those who have humbled themselves and have come to me to change their life, they can enter into my kingdom. Those who have not, and thereby they're saying, I don't need God, I could do it my way. Well, guess what? Your way is failing. It's failing you, your neighbors, your family, your world. God's way works. So at that time, for us, it's when we come to the end of our life, and after that is the judgment. At that time, what we've done with Jesus Christ will determine our eternal destiny, where we will live and how we will live forever. By the way, people have been listening to that debate on our website, Michael Shermer, if you want to check it out. And they've been emailing Scientific American with the most interesting comments. It's not just distractions from the Easter Bunny and Santa Claus and NPR and subjective evolutionists that we contend with. Near our neighborhood tennis courts stand a building that houses a Christian ministry known as YWAM, Youth with a Mission. It's a neat Christian group. And this weekend we're playing tennis out there, and two Christian teenage girls, they're walking around the tennis courts just getting some fresh air. And we can hear them every time they go by. They're having some excited conversation about God, and that's neat. And so I've got Zachary, we're done. I whooped up on my opponent. Won the set. I'm getting Zachary. I wasn't playing Zachary. That would have explained. That would have explained. I see. But just as we're getting our stuff together, the two girls are walking by, and, you know, I can't resist to interject a little biblical material into the conversation. I said, could I ask you ladies a question? They're like, sure. Who had the greater sin, Pilate or Judas? And they were like, wow, a Bible question. Who had the greater sin, Pilate or Judas? And so the leader of the two took over. And she said, well, Judas was a disciple, and he was very close to Jesus. So he had the greater sin, except that there is no such thing as the greater sin. All sins are equal. Therefore, no one had the greater sin. And I chose to respond to the correct part of her answer and ignore the contradictory part. And I said, you're right. Because Jesus said that Judas had the greater sin because he betrayed his master. He was close. He was a follower. And Pilate, he was a stranger. And then she went on to say, well, you know, there is no greater sin because only to us there's a greater or lesser, but to God there's not. So I said, well, Jesus said Judas had the greater sin, right? And is Jesus just a man like us, or is he God? Well, he's God. So to Jesus, Judas had the greater sin. After all, it was Jesus who he betrayed. So Jesus said he has a greater sin. She's like, and I see her friend wondering who's right here. And then I pointed out where Jesus said, some people in hell will be punished much more severely than others. Because they knew more. They knew the truth and they rejected the truth. Some people go to hell and they bring only themselves. Others bring their whole family with them, or even more. So Jesus said they will be punished with many stripes, others with fewer. And then I gave her a list of verses that there are lesser sins and greater sins. And she was very hesitant to give in. She'd be giving up a cliche for Christ's words. Jesus said, who has the greater sin? Judas. But Christians don't want to believe that because our lives are filled with distractions. And the distractions are not just on the outside, they're on the inside of the church. If we don't tell the world that some sins are greater than others, the world will think that we're off our rocker. What do you mean? Cheating on your income tax is the same as being a murderer? We should say, no, cheating on your income tax is good. No, sorry. We have some IRS agents that tune in occasionally to the website. Only joking. It was humor. We may edit that out anyway. Good point. Doug's leaving it in, he said. But if we tell the world, if we buy into the distractions that are things that are contrary to the Word of God, we're causing a lot of trouble for ourselves. And these diversionary tactics, look at all the forms they come in. The Easter Bunny, flying reindeer, worshiping the sun and the moon, denial of the Bible statement that the sun is a light. But the central act of the divine drama that occurred on the human stage 2,000 years ago, that's what we need to focus on. In John chapter 19, if you want to turn there, we only have a few minutes left. John chapter 19, verse 16. Pilate delivered Jesus to them to be crucified, so they took the Lord and led him away. And he, bearing his cross, went out to a place, the place of a skull, which is called in Hebrew Golgotha, where they crucified him and two others with him, one on either side and Jesus in the center. Now Pilate wrote a title and put it on the cross, and the writing was, Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews. And I'd like to go down to verse 41. The Lord was crucified outside of the city walls in Jerusalem at a place where the Romans were executing criminals. And after he died, well, in verse 30, so when Jesus had received the sour wine, he said, it is finished. And bowing his head, he gave up his spirit. In verse 41, now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, a new tomb in which no one had yet been laid. So there they laid Jesus because of the Jews' preparation day, for the tomb was nearby. We were just there a few weeks ago, many of us here in this church. And just outside the city wall, right where you'd expect, is the place where even today, 2,000 years ago, in a steep cliff, the cliff was created. It wasn't natural. Solomon quarried out the rock of Mount Moriah on the summit. He quarried out the rock and he used it to build the temple in Jerusalem. And he left just where the summit, he left the summit. He took out a massive amount of rock for stones to build the temple, and he left the summit of Mount Moriah. The temple's built on Mount Moriah. That's where the Jews offered the sacrifices for the forgiveness of their sins. But those sacrifices pointed to the ultimate sacrifice when the Son of God would be sacrificed on the same mountain where Abraham offered up his son, Isaac, on Mount Moriah. And Christ was crucified there on the summit of Mount Moriah. And it still today, to this day, looks and reminds you of a skull with deep eye sockets, deep in, like a human skull. And then John writes, and in the place where they crucified him, there was a garden, and in the garden there's a tomb. And sure enough, at that place, Golgotha, the skull, there's a garden. Still 2,000 years later. Now, does that mean it was a garden back then? We know it was in the time of Herod, in the time of Christ. Because there's a wine press there, a huge wine press for crushing grapes. And it's a rough climate in Israel to grow grapes in a vineyard. You need water. You need a huge supply of water. You can't count on the rain. And right under that garden, there's a cistern, huge. It's under the ground. They dug it out of solid rock. It holds over 200,000 gallons of water. There's a photo of it. You can see it in our Mount Moriah video, of a ladder with four adults standing on the ladder with a lot of space between them. That's how tall this underground room is to store water. And they'd use the water, they'd collect the water when it did rain, and they'd use it to water the garden, grow the grapes, and use the wine press. And that's all a symbol, the grapes being crushed and the blood of the grape. Christ said, "This wine is the blood of my covenant." That's the place where Jesus Christ was crucified. And it says, in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden. And in the garden, there's a tomb, a brand new tomb, never before used, with a big stone that would be rolled in front of it. And you could see the footage, the video, photographs, books. Our group saw the deep trench that was carved into solid rock for this massive stone to roll in front of the tomb. And you go inside the tomb through the entrance, and there's a weeping chamber and a little doorway to the right and a place for two bodies to lay. And the Bible says that when the women went in, because the stone had been rolled away, there was an angel sitting on the right. And this tomb, that's exactly where the angel would sit. You go in, there's nowhere to sit except for on the right. And the angel said, "Who are you looking for?" And he motioned and said, "He's not here, he's risen." And right behind where the angel would be sitting, that's where they laid Jesus Christ, his body. That's the only place to lay the body. Because there are two places for bodies to be laid in that tomb. A husband and his wife, Joseph of Arimathea, and his wife, the rich man who took Christ's body and buried it in his tomb that was nearby. And they finished the fine work for the one body, but the workers had never finished the other body. It was a tomb in progress. It was 98% complete. They had a little bit of finished work to do, and they never finished it. Why? Because Christ was laid in that tomb. And it was from there that he rose from the dead. So 2,000 years later, we know when John says, and the gospel writers say, the tomb was brand new, it had never before been used, we can tell that today. And it was in the place of a garden, we can tell that today. And it was outside of the city, we can tell that today. And it was right where the main road went by, so the citizens could see don't break the law because we crucify people who do. And it was on Mount Moriah, just like we're told way back in Genesis at the time of Abraham. It all fit together. The evidence is overwhelming. Christ is not on the cross. He's not in the grave, but it's an empty tomb. He has risen. May God bless you all.
Now, Bob said last year he went over the evidence for the resurrection, and he did, but he had to reiterate it. I mean, it's so exciting, and it's so overwhelming, the evidence that we have at the Garden Tomb. And when I went to Israel, I mean, it was, to me, I couldn't see it being anywhere else. I can't imagine that there's a whole lot of rock formations or places where people have quarried that looks like the place of the skull that's outside the city, that has a garden, a wine press, a cistern, that fits all these criteria. And it's in my mind, it's 100%. I don't know how many of those things can be just coincidence. That's where he was at, and we have proof to this day, which is just amazing. Because even the city walls are only 1,500 years old, but the tomb of Christ is 2,000 years old and remains today. You can get on a plane and go and see it, and you can see the evidence for yourself. It's dramatic. So I don't know what else to say. It chokes me up just thinking about it, because it is so dramatic. And when you look at Golgotha, you see the skull. It floods back all these memories and all the stories in the Bible, and it's the truth. So go out and tell a friend, and remember, as always, do right and risk the consequences.